right there.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. You know, I love AA in Philadelphia. I get a chance to come down here every once in a while, and it's always special. I remember this room from about, I don't know, 4 years ago, getting an opportunity to speak here. And there was just such enthusiasm. There was that enthusiasm for recovery that is missing in, you know, a lot of groups, unfortunately, out there. And, you know, when you come across a group like this, you need to support it and you need to appreciate it, because I think that the lack of enthusiasm is what kills us so often as alcoholics. I think if we don't stay enthusiastic about our participation in AA and the recovery process, we don't stay. And if we don't stay, you know, all else fails, usually. That's been my experience, and my experience working with others. I've been asked to speak on sponsorship tonight, and I am going to do that. When you look back, because Alcoholics Anonymous today is, what, 76 years old? You know, AA's birthday. That is terrific. You know, God bless Alcoholics Anonymous. I would be so dead back, you know, 19, 20 years ago, I would have been dead if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was fast drinking myself to death. I had a case of alcoholism that was so aggressive, so progressive, that every single time I picked up a drink, I had absolutely no idea where it was going to take me. And I drank until I passed out. You know, for the longest time, I thought that my drinking, my specific drinking habit, was to drink until I passed out or fell asleep. Well, I later found out through working with some clinicians that that's alcohol poisoning when you pass out. When you drink to the point where you go unconscious, that's alcohol poisoning. So every single night I was poisoning myself with alcohol. I was not going to last much longer. And I had tried treatment. I had tried outpatient. I had tried, you know, just swearing it off. I tried the marijuana maintenance program. Anybody in here ever try that? You know, how'd that work for you? You know, it didn't work much for me. I even, at one point in time, I even decided I was going to start to use heroin to cut back on my drinking. All right? Now, where, you know, why do we need sponsors? You know, it's because ideas like that didn't make sense to us, you know. Sure, that makes a lot of sense. I'll just do that. And I'll tell you my life got pretty decadent pretty quickly armed with that solution. Anyway, you know, the last house on the block for me was staggering into Alcoholics Anonymous with a willingness born of desperation, because I really didn't want to die in disgrace. I mean, I was at the lowest point in my life. My family had run. I had lost 13 jobs in 10 years. I had not a friend left that had a real name. You know, I had friends that had aliases and stuff, like Weezer and Green Man. And there was a guy I used to party with called Rat, and he spelled it with two T's, you know. He had to make that distinction. So, I mean, my life was really, really looking ugly, and I would have been on the streets if it wasn't for a mother that didn't know any better. She just wouldn't let that happen. So I'm 32 years old. I'm living at home with Mom, you know, drinking vodka and bourbon every night until, you know, I was slowly going insane and getting violent and burning the house down by accident and waking up in jail and, all, you know, all the fun stuff that happens to us. And I just didn't want to check out that way, and I had enough willingness because of the desperation. I had enough willingness to go into AA one more time and you know, say, okay, I'm beat. And I got myself a sponsor the first day back into AA. His name was Fish Food Phil. Everybody had nicknames back then, and through inventory, one time I learned that it was because I was nicknaming them. That was, you know, there's still people called Radio Shack Mike who haven't worked at Radio Shack in 20 plus years. They're still called, you know, they're still all nicknamed, unfortunately. But Fish Food Phil, I remember going up to him on day two, you know, still shaking and detoxing. And I said, Phil, I've been in hell. I want to get out. Tell me what to do. Now, if you knew me at any kind of a level, you know that I had to be pretty beaten to say something like that. Because I never cared about your opinion. I never cared about laws. I never cared about what other people's ideas were. I had my own, and I thought my ideas and my perception on life and how it works was much superior to yours. You know, I had maybe a dark, complicated perspective, you know, based on the trials and tribulations of living a life like mine. But I was acutely aware of injustice and hypocrisy at an amplified rate. And I knew what was going on out there and what was wrong with it. So I really thought, I didn't need your help, thank you. So for me to say something like that to somebody, I had to be thoroughly beaten. And I was. Because the last drunk I had lasted about 6 days, complete drunken blackout, where I threatened my family's life. And I mean, you know, you come out of something like that so horrified that could have been you doing that, you know, that you were capable of that kind of horrendous behavior. And I also knew I was very, very capable. If I was capable of threatening their lives, I was capable of killing them easily, you know, in the states of mind that I was going to with this alcohol. So, Phil, tell me what to do. Now, just to talk a little bit about the history of sponsorship, where does it come from? I'm a big book guy. This book is my manual. This is my life manual. The principles for my operational methodology come out of this book. And only because I have tried everything else and then I tried this stuff, and this is the stuff that worked for me. So it's only out of my own experience do I say that. Now, in this book, it doesn't really talk about sponsorship, except maybe in the stories. In 1938-39, when this was being written, they didn't have sponsorship as it looks in AA today. But they did have the best of what today's sponsorship is. They had people who would do 12-step calls on you. Really, what they called it prior to the big book being written was witnessing. Okay, what you would do is you would find somebody that needed help. Find somebody who might want what you have, which is a new way of life based on spiritual principles. And you were to target alcoholics, and you were to try to go and talk to them and tell them a little bit about yourself. Engage them to the point where they become curious about what happened. Okay, if you were like me, what happened? And then you were to lay out the simple kit of spiritual tools, which was basically the Osher Group precepts after the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written. They were the 12 steps. And you were to lay this out in front of the newcomer or your prospect or your protege. And if they were interested, you were to take the time out of your life to take them through the steps, to help them out with these spiritual exercises. And then once they were involved in those spiritual exercises, you could bring them to the meetings, the closed meetings. If someone wasn't actively engaged in the step process around the time of the big book, they didn't want you in the meetings. They had bouncers at the doors, usually, in these meetings in the early days, where you had to be qualified. Somebody had to vouch for you. You could just walk into AA and raise your hand. I got a desire to stop drinking. They could care less about that. What they cared about was, do you have enough of a desire to stop drinking to work with somebody and start going through these spiritual exercises? If you don't, we have nothing for you. So what the sponsor, in effect, was doing was they were in charge of helping to guide the new prospect or protege through the spiritual exercises so that they could become, in effect, reborn, recover from alcoholism, have a new attitude and a new outlook on life. And then they, in turn, were to do that with other people. They were then supposed to go out and find other alcoholics. AA was done on the street back then, folks. We do so much of it today in the meetings, but AA was on the street back then. If they had one meeting a week, that was probably a lot. Most of the work was done in the insane asylums and in the hospitals and the dry out tanks and down in the Bowery, where you would go every single night or every single day whenever you had free time and try to find these people that were still sick and suffering and engage them in this process, in this spiritual rejuvenation that they were that they had learned in the Oxford group. So they didn't have sponsorship as it looks like today, but they had the best of it. Today you can find sponsors who don't have experience taking people through the steps. They're basically oral tradition sponsors. They offer you what they have, and a lot of times they don't have a step experience, because in Alcoholics Anonymous it's become quite popular to just do the meetings and believe that going to a lot of meetings is working a program. And there's a lot of areas where that's really what they think. But when you go back and when you study our basic text, you start to see that that's not really what this is about. The meetings aren't really what this is about. The meetings are where it can start, and the meetings are where we can gather together and support each other in this way of life, the 12-step way of life. But as a sponsor, our work is not in the meetings. It's face-to-face, one-on-one with the alcoholic, getting them to a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps. Now, in the early days, Alcoholics Anonymous was working with hospitals. One of the things that they did in the first 10 or even 15 years was, if you were a prospect for AA, they put you in the hospital. Whether you needed to go there or not, they had deals in Akron and they had deals in New York with different hospitals, and they'd put you in your own room. Most of the time, there were double rooms back then, so getting your own room could be scary for you, because a lot of times the only time you got your own room is if you were going to die. So all these alcoholics are now in their own rooms. That's scaring the hell out of them, a lot of them, thinking that, you know, this may be it. And then in comes one alcoholic after the other telling their story and doing 12-step work. One alcoholic after the other. They put you in the hospital for two reasons. One of them is to show you how much trouble you're in. Alcoholism is an illness that one of the basic characteristics is an inability to understand at a significant level how much trouble you're in. You minimize. You know, here you are in the bombed out bomb shelter of your life after the devastation of 10 or 20 years of alcoholism, and you think going to a few meetings is an overreaction to a problem you really have under control. Has anybody here ever sponsored new people? Oh, wow, man. Go to a meeting every night? Tuesday night, I get my feet scraped. You know? I can't do it Tuesday, dude. Wow. You know? I mean, you're dying. Who cares about your feet? You know, as a sponsor, we can see just how tragically insane they are. Because there's an utter inability to understand how much trouble you're in. So they put you in these hospital rooms to convince you that you have a medical condition that's terminal. And then they start passing the recovered alcoholics past you, one after another, for a couple of days at least, while they're detoxing you, one after the other. And that was the old 12-step goal. And by the time you got done with this, most of those people were ready to become Alcoholics Anonymous members. I did this one time. It's sad to say, in 20-some years of my experience in AA, I only did it that way one time. I got a call from one of my exes, and she said, my brother's in real trouble. He lives up in Hackettstown. Can you help? He's in the hospital. And he was in the hospital from severe alcoholic complications. He had congestive heart failure. He blew up like the Michelin Man, and that's why he ended up in the hospital, because he couldn't waddle anymore at work. You know, a lot of times we just allow ourselves to just go so far down the scale before we do anything. But I decided I was going to do this old school. He was in the hospital for 2 or 3 days. I started sending the boys. I called up everybody and I said, okay, you're at 2 o'clock. You're at 4 o'clock. You're at 6 o'clock. You're at 8 o'clock. Finally, he calls me up in the hospital. He goes, stop sending these people. All right, I'm in, okay? I'm in. So I understand why they did it that way back in the day. And he was in. He became our coffee man. He was so grateful that no one had paid attention to him like that in years. Nobody wanted anything to do with him. And all of a sudden, there was hordes of people coming through, paying attention and telling him that they were seriously interested in his welfare. So, yeah, the old school stuff works. So, you know, I believe so much in these old processes. And there's areas where we as Alcoholics Anonymous members need to step back up. We need to step back up to the plate because we've gotten lazy. We've allowed a lot of the professionals to do a lot of our work. And we want to do everything in the meetings, you know. And our work is out there on the street, unfortunately. Now, to get into these closed meetings in New York and Akron, you had to have somebody vouch for you. Someone had to say, he's mine and he means business, or else you weren't in. So that's where the genesis of the sponsorship that you see today started. And they started calling them sponsors. Who's going to sponsor this guy into the hospital? Who's going to pay his bill if he doesn't pay? We will. I'll sponsor him. And a lot of that was going on, and that's where the terminology started to come from. Now, by the time the step book was written, the sponsor terminology was fixed in a definite way in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think sponsorship is an incredibly important and vital piece of a recovery process today, because we need somebody to guide us through these steps. Being that this is a textbook, the basic text of our fellowship, textbooks need to be taught. I read this book when I was in treatment. I signed myself into a 28-day treatment program, and they handed you the big book. Here's a big book. And I had a lot of time on my hands, right? So what did I do? I read it in 2 days. Okay, okay. I read it like it was the Da Vinci Code. I blew through it. You know, how quick can I read this? And I got nothing out of it, except there was a part in here where it talks about the selfishness and the self-centeredness of the alcoholic. And I said to myself, that is a perfect description of my roommate. I remember, that's all I remember of my experience from this book, okay? I couldn't see where it was me. I could see where it was my roommate who was inconveniencing me with his behavior. You know, so this is a textbook. It needs to be taught. Let's say somebody says, here's a manual for an F-17 fighter jet. Okay, read it. Okay, you read it. Now he goes, come on over here. Here's the jet. Sit down, fire it, spark this thing up, and let's take off. You'd be like, whoa. No, we need some demos. You know, I need to get in the flight simulator. I need some simulator time. I'm not ready for this because there's got to be other things that are involved in the teaching of a textbook. You can't just read it. You know, there has to be a teacher. And today, the best of the sponsors are people who can not only teach you this information, but help you with the enthusiastic attitude you need to do it, and to explain to you and convince you on how important it is to do this. Your chances of recovery are going to be near zero unless you engage in a serious, serious spiritual life. Alcoholism is an unorthodox illness. I just spent 3.5 years mucking around with professional treatment. I was a media director for a very, very large nonprofit organization that's C4 Recovery Solutions, it's called. And I did a webcast show where I would interview treatment professionals. And over the course of 3.5 years, I got to meet the best of the best. All the people who run the rehabs, the people that write the textbooks, the people who invented the clinical processes, all the people who everyone reveres in the treatment field. I got to meet them personally and interact with them. And I got to tell you that alcoholism, from my perspective and from what I've experienced, not only with the illness alcoholism, but with the recovery process of alcoholism, it is misunderstood at such a grand level that it is frightening. The people we pay exorbitant amounts of money to treat us for alcoholism don't even know what alcoholism is. They think that it can be treated with medications. They think that it can be treated with psychological processes. Those things don't even come close to addressing the aggressive nature of alcoholism at its worst. There needs to be a solution incredibly significant in your life. And the only solution that the early AAs came across was a complete personality change at depth sufficient to overcome alcoholism. And that could only come through the stringent practice and adherence to spiritual principles and spiritual exercise. That's what they learned when they were messing around with the Oxford group and some of the other early groups. So that's what was put in here. Those spiritual exercises. That's why there are AA members today that want to hold on to this book and the magic that's in it so tightly. They don't want to let the New York people get hold of it and rewrite it. You know, we want this to remain as it is because there is so much magic and so much power in it. Everyone has tried to write books on alcoholism and alcoholism recovery. You can't shake a stick without being on late night TV and somebody's come up with a pill or a new process for recovery from alcoholism. They don't even know what alcoholism is, let alone are offering a solution to it. You know, they don't know the difference between a real alcoholic and a heavy drinker, nor do they care. They don't understand what powerlessness means, what hopelessness means, compared to someone who, if they honestly wanted to, they could quit entirely or even moderate. They don't know the difference between those two completely different categorizations of individuals. And in treatment or in their processes, they put us all together, and the only successes they ever achieve are with the heavy drinkers, never with the alcoholics, these professional treatment people. That's where this comes in. That's where this is the last house on the block for the people who are in real trouble with alcoholism. Now, as a sponsor, what's my job today as a sponsor? I'm going to go through this a little bit because I take sponsorship very seriously. There's been periods of time when I've spent more hours sponsoring than I do today. My 12-step work looks a little different today than it did 15 years ago or whatever. But there was a heyday when all of my extra time was spent working with other alcoholics. And my best friends in the world today come from that period of time when I was really, really active working one-on-one with alcoholics. Every single night in my house, there would be a fifth step going on or, you know, explaining, going through the big book or helping somebody write out their amends list or whatever. And what I need to do when somebody comes up to me and says, Chris, would you sponsor me? Would you help me? I don't just say yes. That's not a good place to start. What I say basically is, let's get together and let's talk. I need to qualify that individual. I need to be sure that they're an alcoholic. Why? Because if they're an alcoholic, this stuff has to be taken incredibly seriously. If they're not an alcoholic, if I believe that they're a heavy drinker, then there's really no sense of urgency as far as getting them through this. You know, if they're a heavy drinker, a lot of people won't even work with heavy drinkers. I'll help anybody. I don't care. But I won't have a sense of urgency if I don't believe that they're an alcoholic. Because their life probably doesn't depend on this. Their life probably depends on growing up. You know, you got an alcohol problem? Stop drinking. Duh! And there are people that can when you say that to them. The alcoholic is not going to be able to stop because you tell them to. They're going to need a vital spiritual experience to be able to stop. So I need to qualify the individual. I need to know whether they're of the hopeless variety or not. And what I do is the same thing they did back in the day, is I tell them a little bit about my story. I tell them a little bit about how the allergy of the body, that's basically the physical craving, how one drink always asked for the second always demanded the third always insisted on the fourth, and I got tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk. Every single time I picked up alcohol in my last 3 or 4 years, it had gotten so chronic. And you know, I share that, and then I share about the obsession of the mind. I share about how hard I tried to quit, how I honestly wanted to stop. I'll tell them this story. I'll say, look, I would wake up in the morning so ill, so poisoned with alcohol, that my first thought would be, today is the day I'm not going to do this to myself again. I am not going to drink today or tonight. I am not going to poison myself again. I don't ever want to feel like this again. Because I didn't even have what could be considered a hangover. I had this toxic, poisonous ringing in the head, this anxiety, this like shattered, emotionally shattered condition from drinking so much alcohol. You know what I'm talking about. And I'd just be like, ah! And I would struggle, I'd struggle after work. I'm never going to drink again, I'm never going to drink again, I'm never going to drink again. And I meant it. If there was a polygraph guy there and he hooked me up to his lie detector hooter and turned it on and asked me, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? I would say no, and it would go beep, beep, beep. He's telling the truth. This guy's never going to drink again. You can bet money on it. He's telling the truth. Because I meant it at 8 o'clock in the morning. Here's what would happen. I'd get half a sandwich down. I'd rehydrate, you know, half a gallon of grape drink or whatever. And I'd start to feel a little bit human around 2 o'clock. And quitting time is coming, right? And you know what you do at quitting time? You go to the liquor store. So I start to think to myself, you know that decision that I made this morning about never ever drinking again? I'm going to have to modify that. That's an overreaction. Never drink again, you know? I think I'll stop at the liquor store and just buy like a quart. I'm not going to drink the whole quart. I'll just buy the quart. You know, and the whole thing would start all over again. And I explain this to the newcomer. And if they're an alcoholic, they're going to go, yeah, yeah. You know, I can't believe you're saying this. That happened to me. So I'm helping them qualify, and I'm understanding that they're an alcoholic. Then I start to talk about dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. Now, unmanageability isn't always the crashed cars. It's not always the lost families or the lost jobs or the, you know, sitting in front of the judge for the 50th time. That's not always what unmanageability looks like. That's external unmanageability. And heavy drinkers get that put in front of them all the time, too. Heavy drinkers get DUIs. Heavy drinkers lose their families from drinking too much. Doesn't make them alcoholic. Any of that external stuff does not make them alcoholic. But I'll tell you what alcoholics have. They have an emotional unmanageability. We're on a good day, we have a sense of uselessness. On a good day, we're restless and irritable and discontented and just regular cranky. That's a good day. A normal day, we're prey to misery and depression and guilt and shame and remorse and anxiety and self-centered fear. And on a really bad day, it's the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's a bad day for us. Setting aside the drink question, does drinking alcohol in huge quantities, you know, bring a lot of that about? Yes, it does. But also, that's alcoholism. That's how alcoholism presents. It presents spiritually, mentally, physically, and emotionally. Why do you think half of the newcomers that come in are on Prozac and every other goddamn thing? It's because they go to these professionals just emotionally blown apart. But that's alcoholism. All right, it's situational for us. It's not clinical. We're not clinically depressed. We don't have clinical problems. Most of us, a very small percentage of us do, but that's like 4% of us maybe have clinical issues. Most of us have situational issues. But when we're in front of a professional freaking out, they don't care if it's situational or it's clinical. Open wide, you know. You know. Now get out of here. I got really sick people to deal with. All right, get out of my office. You know. So why do you think so many people come in drooling when you're first working with them? It's because we're misdiagnosed. Now. So I explained the unmanageability. Is there alcoholic? They're saying, ollie, ollie, oxen free. I'm all in. I understand exactly what you're talking about. Now I need to move to step two. Step two is tricky. When you see step two on the wall, or you go to some certain meetings, you think that turning your will and your life over to the care of God, or believing in God, or understanding that God is a solution, is a religious answer. And a lot of people have already tried religion, and it didn't work. They've already gone back to church and they're still drinking. They've already got a belief system in place about God and it's negative. And they don't think that something like that is going to work. Now, if I walked into the doors of AA and my first sponsor, Fish Food Phil, said to me, Chris, drinking is your problem, God is going to be your answer, I would have said, thank you for the information. I appreciate it. I've got to go now. That's not going to work for me. And I would have known that it wasn't going to work for me. But the problem is, it's the only thing that's going to work for me. I just see it completely wrong. So we have to be really sensitive when we're working with these newcomers. And we have to do things like they lay out in the step book, which is basically the hoop that you have to jump through is larger than you think. You don't need to believe anything about God or spirituality right now. You just need to be willing to follow some direction. Your personal experience with and understanding of God and God's workings in your own personal recovery are going to be your business, and it's also going to be your experience. I'm not going to tell you what kind of God to believe in as an AA sponsor. I'm just going to tell you that if you don't come to a belief in God, you are going to die as an alcoholic. If you're a heavy drinker, you could be an atheist or an agnostic the rest of your life. If you're an alcoholic, you are going to die if you don't start to develop a relationship with God. Whatever that looks like, it is broad, roomy, and all-inclusive, this particular relationship. And the boundaries we put on those relationships are our own boundaries that we put on from being closed-minded or having preconceptions about this particular relationship. It is broad, it's roomy, it's all-inclusive. It's never exclusive or forbidding, as the big book says. So I need to get the newcomer to understand that the spiritual solution is going to be their way out of this whole mess. And I do that by explaining what was going on in the Oxford group when Bill Wilson staggered in drunk with Ebbie. What was going on is they put you in front of these spiritual exercises. They taught you how to take these exercises, to do these things, to get out of yourself and try to help somebody else. And they put you to work. They changed your actions before they even thought about changing your thinking. They had you acting differently. And that's what brought about recovery. We can't think our way out of alcoholism. We'd all like to try. You know, give me the idiot's guide to alcoholism and I'm out of here. You know, that's what most of us want. But you can't do that. You have to act your way out of alcoholism. And I explain that to the newcomer. And then we can move to step three, which is basically, are you in or are you out of this thing? Are you going to do this with me? Or are you just going to shine me on and slowly stop going to meetings and slime out of here like a weasel? You ever have people do that to you? And then they come back about 6 months later. Oh my God, I drank and it was terrible. Look at the surprise on my face, moron. You know, where did you go? Why did you, you know, was I telling you it was a good idea to stick around? You know, where did you go? Did you have a better idea? It doesn't look like you had a better idea. So are you in or are you out? Are you going to do this thing? Are you going to do this thing? Are you willing to go to any lengths? So often we say that to people. Are you willing to go to any lengths? In the chapter Working with Others, which is a great chapter on how to sponsor, by the way. If you want to become hardcore and you want to have high success rates as a sponsor, do what it says in the chapter Working with Others. When you're first exposed to it, you'll say to yourself, oh my God, I can't do that. But if you do that, only 1 in 10 persons are going to work with you. But that 1 in 10 is going to make it. You know, rather than having 10 people fail, at least one of them will be able to recover from alcoholism. Because it is an overreaction to most people doing this stuff. But anyway, it says in that chapter to leave someone the book. Leave someone the book and have them read it before you meet with them again. Why? Because when you ask them, are you willing to go to any lengths, they will now know what any lengths looks like. You'll be giving them the dignity of understanding what the hell that decision is. Because I don't know about you, when my sponsor came up and said something like, Chris, are you willing to go any lengths? No, but yeah, you know, I'm going to say yeah. I don't know what it means. How can I say yes? I don't know what it means. But I'll say yes because I don't want to look stupid. So to get the right decision for somebody to make in the third step, they need to know what they're deciding to do. How do you turn your will and your life over to the care of God? You know, have you ever sat in a closed-minded discussion meeting and somebody's sharing, you know, and all of a sudden someone said, kid, you got to turn it over. And if you're new, you're like, turn it over? How the hell do I do that? You know, go up to that person that said that and ask them, just how the hell do you turn it over? And you'll learn something pretty interesting. Usually they haven't a clue how you're supposed to turn it. You want to know how you turn something over to the care of God? You do steps 4 through 12. That's turning your will and your life over to the care of God. That's what they mean. You're not turning anything over unless you're doing that. You're just lying to yourself. Oh yeah, I turned it over. Yeah, I'm sure you did. Did you make an amends on that? Well, no. Did you inventory it? Well, no. Then you didn't turn anything over, let me tell you. Okay, it's easy to say, God, you can have this one. But that's not what God's around for. You know what I mean? God's not going to do anything for us that we can't do for ourselves. So step 3. So, okay, I'm in. Chris, I'm in. You know, show me where to start. Now I need to break out the book. Now I need to show the inventory. I need to show the person how to do the inventory, and I need to explain to them why they need to do the inventory. You need to do the inventory because your perception on your world and everything in it is wrong. All right, you are asleep, walking around, thinking you are awake. That's how big this problem is. You are seeing everything through the clouded lens of insanity. And we need to get you to a point where you can see things the way they need to be seen in a sound and sane state of mind. And the first thing we need to do for that to happen is show you how wrong you are with your perceptions on the world. And we do that by getting them involved with the resentment inventory. Why? Because there's no alcoholics out there that aren't pissed off at everybody. Pissed off at everybody. I would come to in the morning after a long drunk, lift my head over the pillow, and the first thing I would think or say would be, those bastards! You know what I mean? Because my life sucked, and it was not my fault. It would have been very inconvenient for it to be my fault. I figured out it's all your fault. And I'm pissed. And that's the way the alcoholic... But as long as the alcoholic thinks their problem is out there, they're never going to get anywhere. Because the solution to the problem is in here. It's an inside job. So in the fourth step, you start to show that to your prospect or your protege. Then we look at the fear inventory. Why? Because I don't care. I sponsor a guy who is a WWF wrestler. He was a Harley's Hell's Angels member and a Marine that fought over in the Gulf War. All right, this is one badass some bitch. And as an alcoholic, he was crippled with self-centered fear. There were periods of time he was afraid to go out of the house without drinking half a gallon of whiskey. Because inherent in alcoholism is self-centered fear. It's not a cowardly fear. It's more of an anxiety. It's more of, I just don't feel good here. I'm not comfortable with myself. I'm not comfortable with my environment. I just want to go somewhere. You know, give me my booze and give me my room. And I'm checking out. And all that is based on self-centered fear. Fear of being able to deal with reality as it needs to be dealt with. And it doesn't look like fear. It just looks like uncomfortability. But it's self-centered fear. We need to show the prospect or our protege this. Then we need to look at the guilt, the shame, and the remorse that they're feeling. Because there's not an alcoholic out there that isn't crippled with guilt, shame, and remorse. We're good people, inherently good people that do very bad things. And we're usually fairly smart people that do incredibly stupid things. And if you do that, your self-esteem starts to become affected and you start to believe at a very deep level that you're a scumbag. Because if you weren't a scumbag, why would you do all of that stuff? You mix up the illness alcoholism with a morality problem. And the effects of alcoholism are really what causes a lot of this behavior. So you come in to recovery, or you come into AA, suffering from these emotional states. And we need to look at who we are, especially our intimate relationships. We need to look at them. We need to look at how we operate. How did we operate with these relationships? Did we take hostages? Did we decide that we were going to use people for our own personal satisfaction in one way or the other? Like you're going to behave in a certain way to meet with my expectations, or I am going to be done with you. I mean, was this how we acted out there? And we need to look at all this, because our personal relationships, there's a great line in the step book. It basically says that our alcoholism is caused by defective relationships. Our defective relationships are a toxic condition to us. They deteriorate us in every way, emotionally and spiritually, these bad relationships. Now, I need to convince this newcomer, or this protege, or this prospect, or this sponsee, that they need to share this stuff. The stuff that they've written down, they need to share. It doesn't necessarily have to be with me. It can be with a priest. It can be with a spiritual advisor. It just needs to be with someone close-mouthed who understands and has experience with this kind of thing. And it won't try to talk them out of doing it. They need to be brutally honest. There's at least 5 places in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that says if you hold on to anything, you're drunk. If you're an alcoholic and you hold on to anything, you're drunk. So you need to be absolutely honest. You need to say everything. But even the things that you went to the fifth step, that you decided on the way there that you weren't going to share, you got to share those too. You share all this stuff, and now you start to believe that there's a God that works in your life, because you start to feel it. It's the beginning of the end of isolation from God and man, this fifth step. I need to explain to my sponsee steps 6 and 7 how his character defects are much too large for him to be able to take care of in single-handed combat. He needs to practice spiritual principles and take spiritual exercises around these so that God can remove them. All right, I need to explain this. How does that happen? How does these character defects get removed? They get removed by becoming willing to make amends to the people and the institutions that these character defects have harmed. So you become willing to set right the wrong. You know, this is something that sometimes takes a lot of convincing. I've had a lot of sponsees come to me with 8-step lists and said, you know, I don't even know why I wrote this guy down. I don't care what you say. I'm never making amends to this son of a bitch. Never, ever. Okay, well, let's make amends to all the other ones. And by the time you do all the amends for all the other ones, you're ready to make that amends to that son of a bitch. Because you start to feel the power of God in your life in the middle of this amends procedure. Okay, it also basically says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're an alcoholic and you don't make these amends, you're drunk. So if you've gotten by year after year after year not making these amends, you've got to look at your alcoholism. Are you really alcoholic? Because this book has never lied to me. I have seen so many people get drunk because they have not made direct amends. Now I need to talk to people about these newcomers about step 10. I need to tell them that step 10 is a reactive step. How do you move through the day? How do you react to the world out there when the world is smashing itself into your face? How do you react to that? You need to use these spiritual principles that we're starting to learn. You need to use these spiritual exercises that you've started to take on a day-to-day basis in a reactive way. Then I need to talk to them about step 11, prayer and meditation. This power that you're getting close to, that you're starting to experience, that's bringing you out of active alcoholism, that's helping you to recover mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. This power, you need to develop a deeper relationship with this power. If this is the power that has brought you away from alcoholic devastation, it's worth getting to know this power a little bit more and understanding a little bit more about your relationship with this power. And we do that in step 11, praying, meditating, learning these disciplines. That's another step that's broad, roomy, and all-inclusive. There's so many exercises and so many practices that you can get involved with. The ones in the book Alcoholics Anonymous are a prerequisite, though. You learn how to do them, and then you can branch out into all kinds of other stuff. Then I talk to them about the 12 step. All the time I've spent with you, the changes that you've undergone. So often they are so grateful, and they want to pay me back somewhere. I've been offered money. And I basically say, look, there's nothing that you can do for me. That would be so inappropriate. You know, because I've helped you to help myself. And I start to explain the 12 step and how my being of service and my taking somebody else through these steps helps me maintain my own spiritual growth, helps me maintain my own serenity levels, and how important it is for me to give back what was so freely given to me. And that they need to take responsibility now for passing this on. You don't pay me back. You pay it forward. You pay it out there on the streets. It's how you do it. Now, if I've done my job with all this, I have a recovered alcoholic on my hands. Now there's a lot more growth. There's a lot more experience to be had out there. Now there's the traditions that need to be taught. Now there's the concepts of world service. Now there's a life filled with an ethic of service. You need to develop a service ethic in your life. And you're going to have an incredible life if you do that. Now, that's what they did in the early days. That's how they sponsored in the early days. That's the best way to sponsor. Again, are you going to lose some people along the way who are not really that serious? Are they going to disappear out of your meeting and go down the street to the closed-minded discussion meeting where all you do is you drink coffee and you talk about your day? Yeah, probably. But there's no problem really with that. There's really no problem with that. What you want is you want people that are serious. You want people who are going to do this stuff, who are willing to go to any lengths. Because I'll tell you what, they are what happens with those people is you develop the fellowship you crave. You put together a crew when you do that of people who will take a bullet for you. When you call them up on the phone and you say, hey, I got a 12-step issue down at the hospital. What are you doing? They'll say, how fast do you want me there? You know, how high do you want me to jump? They're going to be that type of support system for you. And I've had the opportunity to develop that kind of a crew in my life today. And I'm just infinitely, infinitely grateful for all of this. Now, sponsorship is something that needs to be taken very, very seriously. If you really just don't have time in your life to be bringing somebody over to your house and taking them through the steps, pass them on to somebody else. The worst thing you can do is say, yes, give me your phone number, and then not engage. That's the worst thing you can do. You can be killing people by doing that. One of the craziest things I ever heard in AA was, this was a saying that was very popular about 20 years ago. If somebody's ready, there's nothing you can say wrong. If somebody's not ready, there's nothing you can say right. And that is a bunch of crap. If somebody's ready, you can sabotage them by not being available, and they can die. So if you don't have time to do this, or you don't have experience to do this, pass them off to somebody that does. If you haven't gone through the steps yet, if you haven't had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, how are you going to carry that particular message to somebody? You can't carry a message of something that you don't have the message of. Because if you don't have a spiritual awakening, you can't carry that experience to somebody. So if you're not there yet, there's no shame in that. Just don't say yes to somebody if they ask you to sponsor them. Pass them off to somebody who has experience with these steps. Because this is life and death. This is no joke. This is no joke. Alcoholics still show up in AA, believe it or not. And they have a short grace period of time before they need to get in touch with a God that's powerful and can act in their life. They've got a short period of time. And if we muck around and tell them, oh, just do 90 and 90, here's my phone number, call me when you get into trouble, you know, we might as well put notches on our big book for all the people we're killing. So take this seriously, please. It's great to be down here in Philadelphia. I hope I've shared some of my personal experience and not too much of my opinion on sponsorship. I've been sponsored continuously since I walked through the doors of AA, and I have sponsored continuously since my 10th month in AA. And I do take it very, very seriously, and I hope that you do too. I think that's where AA is going to be saved, by strong sponsorship. All the problems that AA is having these days, all of them can be solved by strong sponsorship. Anyway, that's all I have tonight. Thank you all for having me.